as you know, was repudiated by the Senate, and he withdrew a man whose back was broken, so to speak, psychologically. And it was then Clemenceau, the hater of Germany and everything German, who was the architect of the Versailles Treaty. This Versailles Treaty was a vindicative instrument which expected from Germany, from defeated Germany, the impossible. There were reparations specified which Germany could not possibly pay, and as a consequence, the Rhineland was occupied by the French people, which again made for more extremism, more for people who said, these conditions cannot or must not be tolerated. We will give our voice to a man who repudiates it all. Because Hitler said, in addition to this Dolchstoß business, he said, when I come to power, I will tear up this document. And people thought, well, the present weak government doesn't do anything to help us. Let's give him a try. Because the government which was then ruling Germany, the Weimar Republic, was a very interesting but rather pathetic affair. The leading party were the Social Democrats, which is a very large, strong party of organized labor. This party was, by its incorporation, by its laws, by its tenets, it was a Marxist party which espoused the idea of expropriation of property and taking it into the property of the state and doing away with competitive business and all these things which I don't have to go into, which you know are characteristic for orthodox Marxism. But this party just had to come into power and had to take the reins, because the Kaiser, to whom all soldiers had sworn undying allegiance until death, you see, he had skipped out of the country, he was the first to run away. He went to Netherlands, and the Netherlands gave him shelter. So the Kaiser and all the other kings and archdukes and dukes and God knows who they were, they all had run. They all were out. So there was no government anymore, and the largest political party, namely the Social Democrats, stepped into the vacuum, and Ebert, who was a saddler, a harness maker by profession and a politician, very simple, an educated man, but very decent fellow. He was made the first president. He was a socialist. And so this party, which gave lip service to an international idea of Marxism, was suddenly faced with a dilemma to represent Germany, even though it was defeated, it was still a nation, and somebody had to govern it. So they stepped into the breach, and they had, from the very first moment on, a schizophrenic condition that on one hand they espoused Marxism, but on the other hand they had to lead a national policy, namely the German national policy. Now, naturally, this antagonized very large numbers of good laborites who had a servitude, as you may have it in industrial England also, who hoped that their leaders would gradually improve the condition, but they never dreamt that they would lead a national policy of Germany. They were the bodies of the other enslaved and disfranchised people all over the world. So the very idea that their party bosses suddenly turned president of the country and got in important political positions in the government, this alienated vast groups of socialists. These socialists said, well, our party leaders have defrauded us, they have deserted us, we look for other people to lead us. And so there was this man there standing in the wings and waiting just for followers. So there was another group which followed him. There were other groups who came to his flags, to his standards, to his swastika. they were those who suffered from the inflation, because these conditions, what inflation is, I don't have to tell you. Unhappily, we have one here. But what we have here is absolute still, absolute child's play against what Germany went through. Because in the closing weeks of the inflation, which was in 1922 and 1923, I had just graduated from college, had my first job. I worked with Siemens in Berlin. And the currency depreciated so fast, about one decade per week. So we had a dollar worth 100,000 marks, and next week it was worth 1 million mark, and next week it was worth 10 million mark, and next week it was 100 million mark. So we had to wait after working hours until the armored car came from the government Reichs printing office with the latest bills. So my salary was, I don't know, $300 million. And with this money, I had to rush the very same evening downtown to buy something, because the next morning it would be worthless. And for 3 days work as an electrical engineer, graduate electrical engineer, I bought a can opener. That's true. I also bought a very nice leather-bound edition of Wilde's Fairy Tales on a pushcart, which somebody had to sell because the money was just running away like mercury. There was nothing anymore. So vast, vast classes of the middle society, of the good middle class, lower middle class, upper middle class, who depended on a steady income, who depended on their dividends, who depended on retirement fees, they were faced with complete nothing, a complete annihilation of everything. Now, they had to sell their silver, they had to sell their carpets, their china, their glassware, their pictures, if they had any. And these people, in their desperation, were driven to anybody who would promise them a change of the conditions. So again, a vast group which then flocked to Mr. Adolf. There was, in addition to this inflation in unemployment of catastrophic extent, to catastrophic condition. And these unemployed who became radicalized, as it is natural, had only two alternatives. Either they flocked to communism or they flocked to Nazism. These were the two extremes. And though they were the extremes, by virtue of the fact that they were extremes, they were quite close together. So the Nazis said, that I heard that, heard them say that, we rather welcome a communist who goes through thick and thin rather than these washy-raggy socialists. We have nothing but contempt for them. But the communists, at least they stand up for a cause. It's the wrong cause. But we will win them to our side. We will win them. You see, these people were fanaticized in a way. They were fanatics which you cannot possibly imagine, because the whole condition of the country were catastrophic. There was another element, and I tell you this all for memory, because what I had written down here, and you can see it, was washed out by the sprinkler system this afternoon. But I still remember these things because I went through. So there was another element. The Germans, for 200 years, almost 200 years, were governed by absolute kings, later emperors. Absolute, in that they gave the orders, and this was just it. And as a consequence, the people had been trained from generation to generation to obey orders. They had never, never, never learned to take care of their own affairs. And when the Kaiser and the other governing fellows were eliminated, when they had skipped or run away or whatever they did, you see, gone underground, God knows what, when they were gone, then there was a vacuum. And as mentioned, that there was the Social Party, Socialist Party, Socialist Labour Party, which stepped into the breach. But this was not the only party. There were quite a number of other parties. Now this country here of ours is blessed with two parties. Now we have a third party, Mr. Wallace, I don't want to go into that. But basically we have two parties, and in England you have two parties. You see, you have the Conservatives and you have Labour, and you have an extremely small group of Liberals which have practically no influence. So there were two parties. One is the governing party, the other stands in opposition, waiting in the wings to take over when the governing party is defeated for some reason or other. And we have the same situation here, as I don't have to tell you. We see sometimes we have a Republican, sometimes we have a Democratic president, we might have a Republican president with a Democratic Congress. You know that all. You know it probably much better than I. But in Germany, where the people never had been taught in school or anywhere in college to take care of their affairs, there grew up a whole number of weeds of parties. And at the time when Hitler came to power, there were 32 parties, the parties of the house owners and the parties of the house renters. And God knows what, everybody fought against everybody else. Everybody looked amongst these politicians for their own ends, and the whole effect was that any effective government, as we know it, simply came to an end. It simply came to an end. So then I think these are the major factors which caused a continuous growth of this extremism. Now, of course, there was another element. Hitler preached, and very shrilling, the battle against the Jews. And there is some point which I may make here to clarify the situation. There were Jews in Germany who had lived there for generations and who had become completely Germanized and accepted by society and in society. But when the war ended from 1918 on, when we had the Weimar Republic, the borders were opened wide and there was a large amount of Jewish people streaming into Germany from Russia and from Poland and from Galicia, from these areas where there were Jews of a, well, I should say, not of a lower class, this would be quite unjust to say that, but Jews who certainly had not become Germanized. This was an alien element, and it was particularly against those Jews who came there from the ghettos, toward which the wrath of Hitler and his henchmen were directed. Now this Weimar Republic not only let these people in, but was completely willing to give them any position they could possibly attain. And industrious and intelligent as they are, within a few years they had captured very many pivotal positions in this rather sick body politic and body economic of Germany. So it was again a vast group of people who were either disadvantaged or who just feared for ideological or other religious reason, God knows what, this strong influx of Jews, that this virulent anti-Semitism could take root. Well, it was then in 1933 that Hitler, in a legal, open election, was overwhelmingly elected as chancellor. I elected no, I voted no for him, and nobody persecuted me. I mean, I put in my card in the box, this was all, well, still a general secret election, the same way as we have it here, but he was overwhelmingly elected as the chancellor, who is the head of the political group. You see, the president is the figurehead, as it is now, like the king in England, you see, he is on the stamps and on the coins, and he makes a few speeches in which he exhorts certain things. The policy is set by the chancellor. Here in this country, the situation is quite different. You see, the president in this country is the top executive, and in addition, the head of his party. in England, the prime minister is the top executive and also the head of his party, but he is not the head of the state. The head of the state is the queen. So in Germany, there was a president, and this was old, venerable, senile Hindenburg at that time, the same way as we had our beloved Eisenhower, who was again the victorious. Hindenburg was not victorious. He was finally defeated, but at the beginning of the war, he was victorious. So there was a great legend built about Hindenburg in the first years of the World War. And so this old Prussian soldier was then elected as president, quite ineffectual and getting definitely senile, and the arch schemer and cunner Adolf Hitler was then the prime minister. He was the Reichschancellor. And with this, then, Nazidom was in power. And from this very moment on, there was a radical change of everything. The newspapers were all coordinated. There was no opposition anymore, same as it is in Russia now. The political parties were dissolved, except the National Socialist Labour Party. I may mention one thing. The very title of the Nazi Party was National Socialist Labour Party. Now, by putting these disparate things together in one world, you already see how cunningly they tried to grab diverse part of the population. National appeal to those people who were, by their makeup, proud Germans and who smarted under the defeat, under the Versailles dictated treaty. And by socialist, he applied to those people to whom he said, "There will be no unemployed anymore on the street. I will see to it, I personally will see to it that the very last unemployed is productively employed in this of our wonderful state." And the same with labor. So the national and socialist, you see, he appealed to this group and to this group, and he succeeded, as I said, by having himself elected and his party elected as the governing party. The newspapers, as I said, were coordinated. The radio, the broadcast, which was state-controlled all the time, was coordinated. And you were inundated with a non-ending stream of propagandistic information. Now, this is all, and there was virulent anti-Semitism, and there was so-called Crystal Night, in which all the windows were smashed, you see, and the stores looted, things we unfortunately know in this country now too, how such things take place. But this was done by his henchmen, by the SR, the SS people, you see, this was also synagogues were systematically burned, and so on. But of course, these excesses, which were the beginning of a period of terror, were not confined to the Jews. They were confined to each and to everybody and to every organization which did not knuckle down. And I can tell you that the Catholic Church, in a very noticeable way, resisted his pagan and nationalistic and totally utopian and catastrophic and criminal ideas, just as well as Protestantism. Protestantism, which, as I mentioned yesterday, was synonymous with Lutheranism, because this was the state church, and while there were probably other sects, they were completely obscure and didn't play any role. So Lutheranism was split right through the middle. There were a considerable number of clergy which flocked to his flags right away, because they had never been taught to think for themselves. They took orders. Now here was this man, which has been elected by the majority of the people. He gave the orders, so we follow orders. You have to understand that. There was another group, which was the confessional church, which said, "We are not going along with that." And the confessional church, for the first time, was then a church which had to stand on its own feet. It was not supported by the state, naturally, it was supported by the contributions of their supporters. So we, understandably, did not become German Christians who equated the Führer almost with God and with Christ, but we belong to the confessional church. In the beginning, the confessional church was tolerated and could use the same building. They had services at a different time. I remember very definitely when my daughter was baptized. This was in 1935. She was baptized in a chapel which was attached to the church, and in this chapel was an enormous fresco of some figure which you couldn't quite make out, was it Jesus Christ or was it Adolf Hitler? It was just so painted that you didn't quite know what it was. Of course, this church, that's true. I have no photograph. It would be much too dangerous. But this, it was a fact, you see. So, this church was used by both groups, by the Hitler crew groups as well as by the dissident group. But during these 1,000 days, during these more than 3 years, I lived in Germany, in Berlin, under National Socialist dictatorship. The situation grew worse from day to day. I have said it repeatedly to other people. It was like if a silken noose was thrown over your head, around your neck, and you said, oh, how funny. What a joke. This whole thing is so abstruse, so ridiculous, so utterly unbelievable. It is not more than a joke. And then there was a little talk, and they say, well, still a joke. And every day was a little talk, a little bit more talk. There was a little bit more propaganda, a little bit more horror. But it was whispered around. It was never denied. It was never put into the open. Now, that's the basic principle of horror, you see. Until one day you have felt the noose was around your neck and you couldn't get out. Now, very fortunately, and I give thanks to God, we had the chance to leave in 1936, just at the nick of time, before war came. Our property was not confiscated. I could go out as an engineer, which to me seemed highly questionable, because engineers were people whom we could well make use of, but we got out. Now, how the situation was, I give you just one concrete example which happened to me. I worked in Berlin in the communication research branch of the government, which was part of the German post office. Like in England, the post office is this branch of the government which is in charge of communication of every type. So you pay to the letter carrier your monthly fee for your radio. Now you do it in England for your TV too, in Germany too, you see. And so there was a large research establishment in Berlin which worked in the research of communication, somewhat like the Bell Laboratories plus RCA Laboratories and so on, all thrown together. So there I worked, and of course we had much contact with international opposite numbers and international meetings, and had certain curves which I drew, and a curve sheet which gave a certain characteristic which won't interest you at all, the characteristic of the ear for certain different frequencies, for certain different noises, and there were certain instruments which were designed to reproduce this curve, and different countries had developed different instruments, and so we got different curves. And Ludwig Röhrmann, one day, he sat down with a piece of cross-section paper and he drew these curves. This was the curves as proposed by the British, and this curve was proposed by the French, and this was the curve proposed by the Americans, and this was the curve proposed by the Germans. And because I like colors, I had drawn these curves in different colors. And the German curve, I think, was blue. And so, armed with this curve sheet, I went to my superior, not to my immediate superior, but to the superior of the superior, Herr Oberpostrat Förster. And I said, well, here is the curve. You are interested to see how the curves of the various countries differ. Now, here is this blue. This is the German curve. And he interrupted me and said, blue, Dr. Röhrmann, what's the matter with you? Don't you know that red is now the color? Red swastikas fly over all of us. You should have painted this red. No, I didn't say anything. A few days later, I want to go to Oberpostrat Förster and see him about some similar technical business. And I go into his office and say to the secretary, can I see Oberpostrat Förster? And she says, he isn't in. I said, where is he? I don't know. Said, you don't know? Why are you secretary? You should know where he is. That's the way I talk. German way, see? And she said, I don't know. I said, now, could you please explain what this is? I don't know, he is not here. That's all I can say. Now, then it gradually dawned to me that somebody must have told his ideas about Marxism. As a matter of fact, he had disappeared, and he was lucky enough that he was retired with pay, that he was eliminated. Now, this is the way these things operated in 1934, 1935. It got, of course, worse, as I said, day after day after day, but I will finish here because the subject of this talk was the rise of Nazism, and I have already reached the point where it doesn't rise anymore, where we had. Okay, questions?
Were you able to sell your property and get out? Were you able to get rid of your property?
I did not have any property except that we have our own personal belongings, which we could put into a lift van, and we had some money, and this money was very badly depreciated to about 10% of its value because the mark was not honored anymore on the international money market, and we had to pay a 25% Reichsflight tax because we were considered inferior as we flew from this country. I got this money back later from the present West German government. Yeah, but at a depreciated rate again. It's more a token, more and more simple. Yeah.
Could you tell us something about the forces Hitler used to enforce what he wanted to? Was it police forces?
Well, I'm rather surprised that you asked that. He had the SR and the SS. The SS was the elite troop who had to trace their ancestry for 100 years, and the SR, this was the black shirts, you see. This was a kind of troop which had sworn absolute, unquestionable obedience to anything which they were ordered to do. You see?
Were these connected with the army? Or
No. They later infiltrated into the army. They were his top private guard. And then there was a much greater SR, the brown shirts, which were originally just rubble which he had picked up in Munich and which had grown and which was indoctrinated and were trained in songs and in marching around, and they were led by Röhm, R-O-E-H-M, somewhat like my name, only my name is Röhmann, but this man's name was Röhm, and this Röhm was a very dangerous rival to Hitler, because his SR was fanatically dedicated to him. So it was not long after Hitler came to power that he, in a completely fictional and trumped-up dramatic action, shot him. And he reported this over the German radio, and everybody was horrified. He made a big homosexual story out of it. He surprised him with a boy, and he was so disgusted he couldn't help. But these are not the people who are my followers, so I had to eliminate him. Yeah, absolutely. It was a murder, apart from everything else. Huh?
Is that also the assassinations of June 30th, 1934 or 33, along that time? The assassination of the AR group?
I don't know what that is.
When they took Rome and all those others. All the heads of the AR, which would be opposing.
Yeah, what was AR?
AR, that was Rome's group. AR opposed to the SS.
Oh, I see. Yeah, well, I don't know who else was shot, but certainly Röhm was shot, by him personally. Okay. Oh, I see. Okay.
Was Germany considered a Christian nation at
Well, let me ask you, are we considered a Christian nation? I mean, that's a difficult question.
Well, we are a minority, yes, I'm sure of that in America, but we are considered a Christian nation.
Well, then I can't say Germany is considered a Christian nation.
It was. Yeah.
They were no heathens, you see. They were no heathens. But I want to say something else in this connection. In a very diabolical way the family was broken up, because a family, as you know, is the nucleus of a communal life. It is the mainspring of communal life. So what Hitler did was this. He had the men organized in cells in his block, you see, and all the men were listed who lived in a certain block, in a housing block. There was a block guard, a man who took their names, and these men were invited, in quotation marks, they invited to come to a political meeting, which is next Sunday at 11 o'clock. So it just happened that it was at the town the church, but of course, well, this was just too bad. So you had to go to this meeting, and after you attended this meeting, then you were told that next Sunday there would be an outing, and there would be a little tactical formation and some exercise again at the same time, you see. Now at the same time, the women were contacted by the lady who was in charge of the women of this group, and they had then a political meeting, and in connection with this meeting, which also happened to be on Sunday church time, you see, they did certain things. And the boys were organized in the Hitler Youth, and the girls were organized in the Bund Deutscher Mädchen, and the BDM, and the Organization of the German Girls. So the tendency was, and it was of course carried through with all the systematic way the Germans are able to break up the families, to separate the children from the parents, to separate the husband from wife, and to group them all together. You see, when I go now here, even in America, into some social gathering, there will be men standing in one corner and choose a gag about things they are interested in. The women sit in the other corner and they discuss things which they are interested in. You see, I personally don't do that. I go always where the ladies are, but that's beside the point. See? So by the same way to cater to these instincts, he had the idea that all the men had to be separated and they had to be trained and indoctrinated apart from the women. So there could not be any interference, mutual, you see. So this is again another element in this process of undermining the existing social structure in order to get the people make to conform to his ideas and way of life. Now I don't want to talk so much, I want to answer questions. If there are any.
The army itself was one of the last groups that Hitler was able to win over, wasn't it?
Yes. The army was, you see, we had only 100,000 man army. This was all that was permitted after the Versailles Treaty. And this army was led by a very enigmatic fellow who said, "The army follows my orders." And so as a consequence, it was a very dangerous instrument. The army was never very much in favor of the Weimar regime, because this was socialist, and they looked down with greatest contempt upon the saddle maker, you see, and his other cronies. So the army was quite aloof, but Hitler could not win the army either in the beginning. So it was definitely posed a threat in the beginning, and to infiltrate into this army, particularly the officers' corps, which were the old imperial officers, which still formed the nucleus of the small but formidable army. This was quite difficult, but of course he succeeded later on. You see, later on the army was infiltrated by the SS, by his black shirt elite people, you see, and consequently gradually won over to him.
I was surprised in reading on Bonhoeffer in the resistance movement how highly ranked some of the people were who were involved in this, like this.
In the resistance.
Yeah.
Well, yes, because there were these high army people who utterly despised all that, and who saw through it, who saw through these things.
One name that came out was General Beck, who think was chief of staff at one time.
Yes. Rommel, too. I mean, he was killed in a faked accident because he was not reliable.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. In France. So it was a nightmare, and I am absolutely confident that such things cannot happen and will never be able to happen in this country, because this country has, since its conception, since it came into being, has always governed itself. The Americans does not take order without asking why. But the German, of course, had been trained to take orders, and even if the orders were atrocious to the highest degree, he still thought it is his duty to obey the orders given to him by his superiors, you see. Now, this is not the American way. So I don't think that such condition can ever take place here. It was an absolute nightmare. Then there were the concentration camps, about which never anything was written or published, but everything was talked around, and consequently, of course, nobody knew exactly what was actually going on. It was only after the American armies finally had overrun these ignominious camps that these things came into the open, and there were many Germans, many good-minded Germans, who up to the very last moment said, this is utterly impossible, we cannot believe this, this is subversive propaganda, I don't want to hear anything about it. Until they really, for instance, the people in Weimar, they were then marched by the Americans, they were marched through the concentration camp, which was an unbelievable shock for them. So you must hold that to them, that they were people who said this is simply impossible.
Bishop Debelius was busy, even if he was in prison in the religious work, wasn't he?
I think he was. And others too. Oh, yes, yes. Well, it is a very unpleasant subject, but I have tried to tell you as objectively as I possibly can to give you the background, how it was possible that such a nation could be perverted to such a degree. That there were these many factors all coming together. Inflation, defeat, deceit by political leaders in which they are trusted, and economic deprivation, and all kinds of other things.
Yeah. How could they finance such a thing? Just as my concern with all of the debts they had in that.
Now, first of all, of course, the inflation has wiped out all capital as well as all debts. Everything had gone to zero.
I mean debts to the other nations they owed it.
And so on. Oh, they repudiated that, of course. Now, there was a somewhat sinister role of the conservatives, of the arms manufacturers and so on, which are, as I have read many times, willing to support Hitler and to back him up. Partly because the high finance and the wealthy industry, yes, because they feared and hated the socialist government, you see, because it was in theory Marxist, you see. In actuality, it was a national German government. In their theory, they were Marxists, so they said, this is fire which we don't want to play, and this fellow Hitler, maybe we can give him a chance, and so they supported him.
Early, he instituted rigid regulation and food rationing and so forth, didn't he?
I don't think food rationing, but certainly any transfer of currency was punishable with instant death, of course. Deaths were very easy to get by, you see. So you couldn't smuggle out. If you try to smuggle out money, of course, you missed your life. You can read it in many books, you see, that people who try to stuff it into God knows what, then they were caught and summarily dispatched.
I thought that was one way that he got stabilization going.
No, I don't think so. He didn't have much credit abroad or anywhere else, no.
No, but I mean at home.
Oh, no, I don't think so. You mean that he expropriated the wealthy Jews and he could live from that for a long time? No,
not necessarily, but I have a friend who lived through this, and she said that the rationing of food was tremendously tight.
During the war, but not under the Hitler regime.
Yeah. She was there before.
Well.
But maybe that.
Did they bring up substitutes for foods like wood, they make potatoes out of wood, and
during the war, there was a synthetic honey made out of some molasses or so, and they wear synthetic fat, which was made out of some unspeakable ingredients, and they wear black bread. It was all pretty rugged. And then they kill the Americans with their beautiful tin cans, and they wear forays into the enemy lines, not in order to reconnoiter or to kill people, but to get their food, to get their American food.
Mm-hmm. How did the German population as a whole respond to this, the image he tried to create of the Germans as the pure race or the
Superman.
Superior, yeah, the super race?
Well, many people, very smallish people, of course, were flattered that they were poofed off because I am a member of the master race, and that's not so bad, you see.
But the reason I wondered about it was because something as preposterous as this, if it had been about the Norwegians, I could believe it. But something as preposterous as this, I couldn't imagine an educated nation taken seriously.
No, it is utterly impossible. It is utterly impossible for you to picture the state of an absolute dictatorship, where you don't hear anything, you don't see anything. You see, you cannot receive any radio by penalty of death. You see, everybody was enjoined to spy upon everybody else. It went so far, good that you just mentioned that, it went so far that the children were exported to spy upon their parents. If they overheard some disparaging remark at the coffee table or so, they were duty-bound to report this to their children's block ward, to their boys' block ward, girls' block ward, and then at 2 or 3 a.m. there came two men, rang the door and said, please come with us, and this was that, you see. So everybody lived in an absolute state of terror. Telephones were tapped right away, and I know that because I worked with the government, and one of the first things they asked me, said, how do we do this tapping? I said, well, I'm not a specialist in this field.
There was a terrific concentration of engineering skills and efforts put into the submarine program. After we had taken a collision in the Baltic in the summer of 46, hauling relief cargo over there, it became necessary to tie up at the yards at Vegasok for about so we could get the crate put back together again. And that was one of the most fantastic engineering jobs I've ever seen there at Vegasok, down to Baser.
Yes.
There were ways, and there were some of those people pretty well convinced that had he had just a little more time with those super submarines that he was turning out for it to last. There were some of these hulls that were still there, plus some of the inner zone while we were getting repaired. There was a fantastic engineering feat up there.
I tell you something else, which may be of some interest. A dictatorship, of course, prides itself to be a completely monolithic block. Everything works absolutely smoothly, because there is no haggling and there is no dispute. Everything is ordered from the top, with everything marvelously organized. But this actually is just a facade, a sham. Underneath this facade, there is just as much jealousy and just as much rivalry as you can possibly think. Everybody says, "Hail Hitler," you see, and then he tries to pull strings to get the most for himself. Now, one of the interesting and to us, I would say, most helpful episodes in this respect was the following. The Germans worked feverishly and most successfully in developing jet fighters. The jet fighters were developed in Germany long before we had them or the British had them. The Flying Fortresses came over unprotected, and you know what heavy losses they took when the big cities were bombed, because the German jets came up in a jiffy and shot them down, you see. So there was a strong desire of those who were in the fighter business to build more and better jets. At the same time, there was this work going on in Peenemünde on the rockets, on the V2 rockets, which was also a terrible terror weapon because it flew faster than sound and it was not detected, and there were no radar at the time, extremely crude radar. There was radar, yes, but extremely crude by our present-day standards. And you couldn't do anything against them. So they came and they devastated cities like, in Belgium cities, and of course they flew to London. So there was a strong faction which said all our industrial, our research facilities, our production facilities must be concentrated on rocket. So here we had two ministries, one the Ministry of Supply and the other the Ministry of Armament, or what was one rooted for jets and the other rooted for rockets. So by this counteracting against each other, one said the potatoes have to be converted to alcohol because we need the alcohol to fire the rockets. No, they said the potatoes have to be converted into God knows what to get the jet planes. The upshot was that we won the war, as you all know, by the grace of God, I can say, because there was no unified effort, these two factions counteracted against each other, and there was no breakthrough which would have turned the tide. But we came perilously close to being defeated in the air war if this rocket business hadn't started. We would have also been, London may have gone to its knees when the jet plane production would have been stopped and everything would have been concentrated to the rocket. But under the pretense of a monolithic block, there was this terrific pull and counterpull. I heard that after the war, of course. I was in this country. Well, I think it's better time to go to bed. Yeah, I read that about quite recently.
Well, in light of the message tonight about the celebration of death, so to speak, why should we as Christians have a fear of being right now?
I did not imply that this is a fear, said that's an ever-present danger. No, I didn't use the word fear. Well, that's, if we get into theology and into religion, and I think we shouldn't do that at this late hour, you see. Depends on your attitude toward death, whether you say death is just the complement to birth. That's an attitude I take. I say the life has three parts. You are born, you live, do the best you can, you die. Well, that's it.
I point back that I would not want to imply by what I said any minimizing of the significance of life as we know it here either. I think that life now is a precious gift, and to do anything to destroy it in an individual or personal way or in a holocaust is a tragic. Even with the knowledge of the resurrection, the destruction of life is tragic. Maybe I didn't make myself clear.
No, you made the thing.
It's probably you were striking a chord that has been ringing for a long time. I've noted in many people, and myself included, an inherent fear of death, I guess, and I feel that I don't have as much of a fear of death as most people do. And I kind of think that if you're afraid to die, you're not living right.
Right. I agree with you completely.
There's so much discussion in religious church social functions about the fear of a nuclear holocaust and that kind of thing. I wonder why people are so concerned about it. If what is to come is greater than what we experience.
Well, do you, excuse me, may I?
Yeah, sure.
Do you feel that, say, that you come to the point where you do not fear death, that this makes life, as we know it now, less precious?
No, but I think that probably the purpose of a function of our life today as Christians is to tell others about Christ, to spread the word. And if we assume that a nuclear holocaust wipes out everyone and that there are no future generations, then the amount of people that can, additional people that can be told the word that are living today is not much different. I guess the gain that we could make is in future generations. The gain that we make today is small compared to what we can make in future generations. And I don't believe that the important thing is the total number of people that know about Christ through eternity, through all time, but the maximum number that know it at any one time. In other words, this is about investing money. We talked about last time investing money in property so that you can have a bigger church in the future. It's important, but important is what you do now. So the important thing is how many people at any one time, the percentage today that know about Christ, and increasing that percentage rather than saying, well, we'll have a big percentage. We'll forget about the people today, but we'll have a big percentage tomorrow. And I think that's wrong. So wiping out everybody today really doesn't change the picture of what today is. And you don't, you have no future generations to worry about. No, life is precious.
I'm going to have to talk to you somewhere else because I lost you somewhere.
I am out anyway, sir. Good night.
Good night. Good night.